Warning, if kids are listening, watch out, because there's some naughty words in the next podcast.
21 Elephants brought to you by Better World.
Okay.
We're on.
Some jokes.
It's good to be back, eh?
Yeah, it's good. Hey, well,
here we are. Scotty's down from Wellington here in Otatahi, Christchurch. He's visiting my house, the Department of Spiritual Engineering, next to the university, and we're in the upper room at my house. It's a rainy day. Recording for Season 4 of the 21 Elephants podcast.
Season 4? Did you think we'd get this far, Spanky?
No. And I thought we wouldn't, because I thought in the end I'd say, I'm done. I got nothing else to say.
Yeah.
But then I think it's something about being a man and being Pākehā. I've always got something to say.
Yeah,
isn't
me too.
Interesting.
Yeah, no, I just sit for long enough and I have another thought that I believe everybody needs to hear.
All good thoughts. Yeah. All worth saying.
Bertha, you flipping weirdo.
Do we need to kick her out? She'll be all right.
No, she's all right.
We have Bertha the cat.
Don't get up here, Bertha. I'm allergic.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm allergic to cats. Bertha is a good-looking cat, though. Hey,
Bertha is our pet, British Blue.
A little bit overweight, hey?
Yep, that's... Yeah, well, she's getting older and you know, bodies work different.
No judgment, older. Bertha.
Bertha was actually...
Bertha, you keep body positive, all right?
Bertha had a sister called Betsy. There was Betsy and Bertha. And we renamed them. So Bertha's actual name, the vet knows her as the Professor.
And where did that come from?
I just thought it would be great to have a cat called the Professor. And the other cat's name was the Theologian.
Ah.
And guess which one got hit by a car?
The Theologian.
Uh-huh. So science did win over religion.
Mm.
And so Bertha, though, Bertha's a gorgeous cat, but you never were, when there were two of them, you could never touch. They would never let you touch them. They just looked good. You know, you try to pet them and they run away. Mm. But as soon as one died, guess who was desperate for attention?
Desperate for affection.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why? Which name do you go with day to day, Bertha or the Professor?
Bertha.
Bertha.
It's like a racehorse.
Right. Yeah. 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 It's like a very overweight racehorse. She's quite a friend looking cat. I don't actually like cats that much, but she's one of the better looking ones.
Yeah, she's a great cat. Well loved.
Yeah. So we have this dickhead cat in my community called Archie. So we start prayers in the morning and we start singing songs. Archie will be somewhere else. The moment we start singing, comes into the room. Starts playing with some catnip or a ball or whatever, climbing up on a chair, licking someone's head. Just like, doesn't care. The moment we try to go to any kind of space of sacredness, all of a sudden, there's Archie being a dickhead.
Yeah, it's a common problem.
It's a rare talent.
For those of us trying to lead any Christian contemplative practice with easily distractible groups, that there is a cat coming to make noises.
She is so keen.
I know, she loves you. She loves you so much. I think she probably would be a good medical cat, and she probably can tell you have some sort of illness. And she's like, I want to come, I want to come and soothe you. And
literally, you my eyes will just weep for about 4 days.
Well,
if you get any closer to me,
Bertha. I'll just get her. There's no point in going through because you always.
No, but I like the look of her. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Oh, shit.
She always puts her claws into the cat. Okay. Okay. You hear that? Yeah, you're a good cat. She's a beautiful cat. British Blue, you see.
British Blue.
I wouldn't...
No, off she goes.
We have to pay a lot of money for very expensive cat food.
Oh. See you, Bertha.
Downstairs. See you, mate. Bye-bye.
Welcome to the 21 Elephants podcast. Hello, Scotty Reeve. Scotty Reeve.
Thank you, Moore. So good to be here. Mm. So good.
Scotty Reeve is such a good friend of mine, and he comes down once a year. It's like we do a little retreat, don't we?
Little retreat centre, except it's like a retreat where children constantly want to play with you.
Yeah. Have you enjoyed hanging out with... we've got three children that Scotty gets to hang out with. Edith, how's your interaction been with her?
Edith, yeah, she's excitable, loquacious. Does that mean large vocabulary?
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Verbose. Very verbose and quite dynamic in her verbosity.
More recently, Edith's big concern, which took a bit of, took a long time to work through, was she discovered cremation existed.
Wow.
As a concept, and that was a shit fight. That was not good.
Tell me about that.
Well, she visited a seat where my grandparents, where their ashes were scattered, and she said, were they buried there? And I said, no.
We lit them on fire.
No, not really.
We lit your grandparents
sort of
on fire.
It's like it's in memory, it's a space, and they were turned into dirt, and put there. Turned into dirt. Well, they were turned into ash and put there. Ash. How does one get turned into ash? It's just a process. It's not important, Edith. Are they put in a fire? Well, of sorts. Are they put in a fire like the one in our house? No, there's a special man with a special fire. Are they put in alive? No, they are not alive. They are dead. And so this went back and forth until I left the room. And sometimes I tap out and say, Sarah, you got to go put that thing out. And Sarah comes out and says, you told Edith they put people in fires alive to cremate them. And I was like, no, we cleared that up. Yeah, Easter's traumatic at our house, man.
Actually, Fried is quite the theologian too. He has some big theological conundrums.
He's more violent.
Patutionary
theologian.
Actually,
you get on well with Fred because everything in Fred to me seems, I think he's a four.
Right.
He's just...
Yeah, he's on the edge of emotional meltdown at every moment.
It's amazing. Do you know what he said to Sarah the other day? It was so funny. Some argument at what had happened, as is always with Fred.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, what is something that you love? And Sarah said, why? Because I will take it and break it so it breaks your heart like you've broken mine.
Did he say... This three-year-old said that.
He said that. What kind of three-year-old is scheming to such? So we started this podcast some years ago after you'd written that fantastic book called 21 Elephants. What was the book was sort of about? You know, faith and justice.
Faith formation.
And, you know, the first series, we were looking at some of the main themes of the book. That was a good time. And then the one after that, we were looking at ancient solutions to modern problems. We went on that road trip. Do you remember that? What was the third one about? The
third one, we talked to people who were dreaming of a different future, a different reality. It was called Artists and Activists. Mm. And, there was a great, great series, eh?
Oh. Very good. And here we are, back again, doing season four for the year. And when Scotty said he thought he had an idea for the series, I both thought, no one's going to want to listen to that. And I also thought, this is the best idea he's ever had. Simultaneous, you know, the worst and best
at the same
idea.
Time.
So tell me about what your idea was.
So season four is called Saved. And it is about people who have been saved by the blood of the Lamb. Can I get an amen?
No, you can't. What I would say is, I think we acknowledge, don't we? We acknowledge that Scotty and I have different... We're on the same page.
There are differences.
Anyway, but we have different feelings about this. If you hang out with Scotty and any of his friends, they're just always talking about Jesus. And Scotty has a certain way of saying Jesus. How do you say it?
Jesus.
Yeah, like that, exactly like that. And he's always saying that stuff, and he's into it, and they're singing their songs, and their hands in the air, and they're worshipping, and it's a beautiful thing to see.
And
it's
then, you know, if you hang out with Spanky, you know, he'll go to great pains not to say Jesus, and then at the end of the night, you'll somehow feel that you are part of the flow of the divine union.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd say Jesus very fast. Not that I've got a problem with Jesus. I love Jesus. It's just everyone I hang out with have problems with everything. So, you know, it's sort of the divine mother energy. I mean, if you'd asked me a few years ago, would I catch myself saying those sentences, I would have said no. But, you know...
A bit of divine mother energy goes a long way.
Regardless, one of the things around this is I think we acknowledge that conversion is a very interesting topic for people, a bit awkward for people. And some of the stuff we're exploring in this season is these are strange conversion stories. These are the ones that aren't normally
on Hillsong does not put these people on stage. They were not at Impact World Tour if you went along to that a few years ago.
So I think the stories that we've got are fascinating. But it also raises, I think, some interesting questions.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't just think they're interesting stories. I think they cut to the heart of some big things actually for what currently younger people are wrestling with. Mm. What do you think it cuts to the heart of?
I've been talking to some of our crew a little bit recently about a quote from Shane Claiborne where he said, "The answer to bad theology is not no theology, it's good theology." And I think that's kind of where we've landed on a lot of our spirituality at the moment is we've seen bad evangelism, so we've decided no evangelism, or we've seen bad moves of the Holy Spirit or manipulative or coercive stuff, so we've said no Holy Spirit. And so this question presses in on that and asks us whether we can believe in a redeemed sense of some of those ideas.
There's a few things I see going on as I often work with people who have come from, say, a Christian family or some sort of faith background, and it feels like you're always dealing with people whom are deconstructing things but not rebuilding things. You know, that they're more discovered that God's bigger than they thought or broader or
perpetual deconstruction.
There's a new issue that they didn't think, and that's fine and important, but actually less often do we get to keep the company, or I do, of people whom haven't had faith or for a very long period haven't and have discovered it and discover some things that we've probably become overly familiar with. And so I think it's fascinating how, while for people who have faith they like to doubt, but often for people who've grown up with doubt, their way of doubting is to explore faith. So I think that's interesting. The thing I was going to say that I've enjoyed around some of our explorations is that everyone has a different journey and a different story, and it seems to me that God deals with people on their level. And even in scripture we see that St. Paul had this sort of Damascus Road experience, boom, you know, hit by Christ in the eyes, going blind, off your horse, got to be led away to some scared Christians to get that healed out here, and you all turned around. And then Peter on the other side, the other apostle, whom took a long time to warm up. You know, it was a much more gradual journey.
Stinky, tell us about your mouth pipe.
About my pipe?
Yeah, tell us about your pipe.
I've set up a thing called
Voice Tube.
No.
No, SpeakPipe?
Yeah, it's speakpipe.com/21elephants. Speakpipe.com/21elephants. And what you can do, there's a thing. It's a thing for people that do podcasts and whatnot, where you go along to there and you click record and you can send us a voice message. So you might have some feedback around the podcast, or you might have some questions.
You have one new message. Message received today at 4:54 p.m.
Kia ora, my name's Michelle. I live out at Ngatiawa River Monastery up in the Rakarangi Valley, just off the Kapiti Coast. Really enjoying your podcast. Really appreciate the stuff that you guys are covering. Finding it's really great information to have good conversations with friends, talking across different church experiences or different faith experiences. And I know my brother and I have had some really good conversations from your podcast, exploring some stuff together. So thank you. My one contribution to your conversation was also enjoying the awkward, God and the awkward. And one of my stories to share is a guest who came to stay with us who I think had had some negative experiences with using some pretty super spiritual stuff at their church. Anyway, they had been asked not to pray for people in our chapel just to protect vulnerable people. This woman ends up praying for one of our friends who was staying. His hand, which had been hurt for many years, his hand gets healed, and he now comes and plays the piano every time he stays. And this great way that God used the person that we'd asked not to pray to bring healing to someone, physical healing. So that's pretty cool. Anyway, keep up the good work. Thanks for the conversations that are curious and interesting, and kind of the questions we're asking, especially loving seeing how God saves people through unusual circumstances. So cheers, guys. Kakite.
Speakpipe.com/21elephants. Who are we talking to? Oh, because you and Rose, what have you guys been doing in Wellington? You've been talking to some people.
Oh, we've been doing interviews.
Oh, so you talked to some people.
Yeah, we talked to some people.
Rose and Scotty.
The next one we want to share with you that we've talked to is Sung Po, or Shang, our friend.
Shang.
And Shang is working for a big car company right in the middle of Tokyo. So we did this one international.
All right, great. So Shang.
Beamed to you between our church office in Wellington and downtown Tokyo.
Thank you. I just ask a small question of what did you eat for breakfast?
I ate this yogurt.
Is Japanese yogurt different to kind of yogurt you get here or much the same?
Surprisingly, the dairy here is like a pretty good standard. Obviously, New Zealand's better, but like it's acceptable.
But this is the country, right, where apparently they like massage cows in the field and play them classical music. Is that right?
Yeah, but it's also like in New Zealand, you get the sort of regular stuff and then you can go like pretty wildly high end too. So, right. So I'm just on the regular level. This is also the country where they hand massage fruit daily. That happens.
Does that not bruise the fruit? Which fruit gets massaged?
Like melons and... I know melons for sure. Like apples and probably larger watermelon.
I was just thinking about how I knew of a time that watermelons were grown to be square in Japan. Like growing them in kind of trays so that they would stack better.
Do you know anything about square melons?
I've seen them in the supermarket. They're wildly expensive. Fruit is more of a luxury item here than an everyday staple. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, buying one apple is about $2.50, and it's not guaranteed to be good. So,
Right.
Rosa said you grew up in the Waikato. Do you want to tell us a little bit about where you come from?
I was born in Taiwan and moved to New Zealand when I was 2.5. My parents were Taoist missionaries, and that's why... They decided to move to New Zealand and grew up in the Waikato, being a confused second culture child, or is it third culture? I'm sure.
Can we just step back a second there? So Taoist missionaries, so they came to New Zealand to convert people to Taoism?
That's correct, yes.
What is Taoism? Give us that in a nutshell.
As I understand it, how it was shared with me was Taoism translates to the way and the truth, and it draws from religious practices and religious teachings from a number of different religions, I guess, from Confucianism, Buddhism, Muslim, and Christian traditions.
Okay, interesting. So they came here to share Taoism with people when you were two, did you say?
Yeah.
And then what happens next?
And then I proceed to be a very confused child, confused in communication and confused in identity for the remainder of my schooling years, and even now, sometimes. The story goes, we went to Auckland for the first 6 months, and growing up in Taiwan, I only spoke Taiwanese, and so I had to learn Mandarin very quickly from all the other kids so I could learn how to communicate with the other children. 6 months later, I was three, and we got a house in Hamilton. I was then sent to kindergarten, in English-speaking kindergarten in the Waikato, and had to quickly learn how to speak English.
Three languages in 3 years, that's pretty hectic.
I don't know how fluent I was or how effectively communicative I was, but yeah.
And so you kind of grew up with your sense of kind of cultural identity was like quite confusing for you because you'd kind of been in all these different spaces, is that right?
As a kid, as a five-year-old, as a 10-year-old, as a 15-year-old, you could only identify that you looked a bit different than everyone else, that you had something else different going on at home, but weren't able to quite communicate that.
In terms of, like, the Taoist community around you guys, like, were you kind of embedded in a wider community, or was it sort of your family doing its thing quite like a family pursuit?
Growing up, we had a little chapel upstairs in our house, which every Sunday we'd have church and we'd have people come by. And in terms of wider community, there are Taoist churches all through New Zealand. The main hub was in Auckland, so we spent a lot of time travelling up to Auckland and back.
For you, what feel like the main kind of truths or ideas that you took on board from Taoism growing up?
Because it draws from Christianity, because it draws from so many different faith traditions, broad strokes, it was about how to morally and ethically be a better person, spiritually as well, and to kind of learn from stories and teachings of Confucius, Buddha, Jesus, about sacrifice, about loving your neighbour, about just generally trying to be the best person you can be.
Am I right in thinking that you ended up going to a Catholic school as well?
So after a few years in public school, from year 1 to 6, of which there was no mention of God whatsoever. So during intermediate high school, my parents, for some reason, decided to send me to Catholic schools. Then we started talking about God, which I was like, awesome, this is great. But what caught me off guard was that the language, the terminology, how people spoke about God and how people thought about God was not entirely the same understanding that I had.
How people talked about God at school, it didn't connect with yours?
There were definitely parallels. So I think I got really good at compartmentalizing. So at school, I would kind of talk about God in a certain way. And at home, I'd talk about God in a different way. But during that time of trying to figure this out, I still strongly believe, even to this day, that like it was the language that we chose to describe our relation to God and Jesus and how he chooses to show up in our lives. It was the language that we chose to use that was different rather than God or Jesus or the Holy Spirit that was different or that I was praying to some idol. You know, growing up, I had a more personal relationship with God. And as I grew older, as I went to explore Christianity a bit more through Catholicism, and as well as kind of delving deeper into my Taoist faith, the conversation strayed towards more of a head religion, whereby it was just learning rules. It was learning you do this for this reason. The conversation strayed from a heart, a knowing of God, an experiential God, to prescriptive, a judgmental, a sort of all-knowing, separate entity. And in both Taoist and Catholic teaching, which I was very confused by.
A really interesting thing I think you've said is that as a child, you had kind of a sense of a relationship with God, but somewhere along the way, it kind of got hijacked by kind of these rules and regulations, both within Taoism and both within Christianity. And it's just interesting that almost the way you talk about your journey to Jesus is a return to something you knew as a child. Is that what you're saying?
I was reflecting on this last night and thinking about my journey to Jesus and just thinking back to when I was a kid to even many moments as an adult today. Going into church, regardless of faith, regardless of if it's a Christian church or a Taoist church or a mosque, these holy spaces, you can't help but feel the presence of God in these spaces. Every week we had to go to church in Catholic school, and I loved it. I felt safe. I felt the most at peace out of any other space. I felt like it was home, and I couldn't explain it. I couldn't, to this day, like apart from my wife, I haven't actually shared that. So there was, I guess, a deep connection and a deep knowing from the very get-go, whatever influenced that, I'm not sure, but church always just felt like home. The coming to Jesus part is a bit complicated once you accumulate all the identity crises and spiritual crises throughout this journey, but yeah.
So you've articulated that you felt at home and you had this kind of home and safe place with God. There was a sense of communion and connection with God, like as a young person and in sacred spaces. What drew you to actually like specifically choosing to speak to Jesus? Like, was there points of difference in that?
I kind of started to think about choosing a religion, I guess, having choice around what I do and how I interact with God once I left home and once I went to university, because in the absence of my parents, parental pressure, I guess, and that obligation to go to church regularly, I, for the first time, had the choice to. And I found myself not really looking forward to going to church that often because I had a bunch of questions. I was very confused that this God we were hearing about, these teachings we were hearing about, just weren't connecting with me. And so through that, I met some really good friends in university, fortunately. And the good friends, a lot of them who've stuck around, turned out just so happy to be Christian. They invited me along to church a bunch of times, and they treated me with more grace than I deserved, to be honest. And they were patient, and we had many conversations. But during that time, I guess I still was carrying a lot of hurt and a lot of confusion from understanding who God was to me and who I was to God. Bit more context. My dad was a chemistry teacher and my mum was a maths teacher. So I grew up in a very logical mindset. So it was like just trying to figure out what I needed to do to be good was mostly the conversation, and figuring out what that meant with God and figuring out if that was even correct. So I went to a number of churches throughout university. Nothing really stuck. And I think partly it was because I wasn't open to that And in part, going to a Christian church to me felt uncertain, as in I wasn't sure if I was allowed to go. That was a large barrier. Although a lot of the Christian traditions and Christian values resonated with me, coming to the step of choosing to be Christian, feeling like if I chose to be Christian, I would be relinquishing all my past identity and family and cultural traditions. So that was a huge part to me, like being able to step in the door, but not being able to fully commit to anything.
I think that's really interesting, particularly for Pākehā New Zealanders like Rose and I here, that, you know, there is a cost to coming to Jesus, but we don't really know what that cost is because it's so bound in our cultural tradition. It's part of being a polite Westerner. I definitely know Pākehā folks who have paid a cost for their faith, but I think often that cost can be a lot less because our spirituality is so segmented from the rest of our identity. You can change your spirituality as a Westerner and have it not impact the rest of your life. But I think when you go to other parts of the world, particularly when I've spent time in India, you realize that it's almost impossible to pry apart someone's spirituality from their community and from every other thing about them. Talk to us a little bit about, you obviously had the kind of the working out of this might be a thing for you, but at some point, I guess, Jesus started to become real to you, you know? He ceased to just be another possible philosophy, and you started to go, what's this about?
So what happened during my university years was my dad was diagnosed with cancer, and I respected my dad a whole lot. I loved my dad, and this is my pal. Witnessing a man who dedicated his whole life to faith be almost punished in that way was hard. Like, I have no words to describe it. It was extremely difficult. Physically, mentally, spiritually, because you're watching this man you love die. At the same time, you're asking yourself questions like, God, how can you do this to a man who has dedicated his whole life to you, you know? So following that, there was just a long period of radio silence with me and God, because I didn't know what to do with those feelings. I didn't know what to make of the situation. There was no one to blame. There was no reasoning for it. It didn't fall within my logic framework of mathematics or chemistry or any other way you want to put it. I couldn't work it out. So I just chose to ignore it, to be honest, which isn't the best solution, but as a 20-something-year-old, that was the best I could come up with.
Elephants will be back in just a moment. Why do we have to do that part?
Because we have to play an advert.
Oh, an advert, an advert. What advert?
This season we are lucky enough to be sponsored by NZCMS and their Better World Gap Year program. I'm sitting here with my good friend Guy Benton. Guy, can you tell us a little bit, what is the Better World Gap Year?
Yeah, kia ora Scotty, kia ora everybody, it's great to be here. Better World Gap Year is an epic opportunity for high school leavers and young adults to jump on, have radical adventure with one another, dig deep into unravelling what the big issues are in the world, how they play a role in what we do, how do we interact with them, where do we even start? They're huge. Who's doing what, where, why, how, and how that all kind of relates to sort of faith me as a Christian and my impact on the world.
So if there was someone out there who really loved the last season of this podcast, Artists and Activists, that might be a good next step for them?
Yeah, people who are just not sure what they're up to and they want to have radical adventure and they want to trip around. Someone who's passionate about a big justice issue or they're passionate about figuring out where to start.
And so this kicks off in about January, February?
Yeah, so we usually look to start in February and we go for about 8 months and then we're just tripping through New Zealand, engaging with people who are doing hard mahi in the area of justice, engaging in communities who are doing some awesome work, unravelling what is the story of this land. In previous years we've gone overseas, but of course you know where
COVID.
We're at. COVID. Absolutely unpacking what that looks like here in New Zealand and how we might engage in that when we're allowed to go overseas again.
Yeah, I actually think that's awesome that you're kind of stuck here, because sometimes it can be easy with justice issues to think it's all out there, but yeah, to actually wrestle with what's here is awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if people wanted to know a little bit more about this, where can they find out?
Yeah, you can jump onto our website, betterworld.org.nz, or check us out on Facebook or Instagram.
www.betterworld.org.nz. Awesome.
Cool. Yeah, cheers.
Then came along my wife Sharon, who at the time wasn't my wife. So I met her at a mutual friend's wedding, so we had a lot of friends in common. And
can I just say, I remember being at that wedding and looking across the room and going, who's this guy Sharon's hanging out with?
Yeah, so we had a lot of mutual friends in common, and I knew a lot of them went to a church called Blueprint.
That sounds amazing.
I was just waiting for that interjection, eh? I was like, I'm going to listen to Shang, but Scotty's probably going to interrupt.
Sorry. Carry on. You found this wonderful kingdom of God here on earth called Blueprint. Carry on.
I mean, obviously, I didn't know all that instantly. I got to know Sharon a little bit more. And on our third date, I believe it was, I invited along to my work Christmas party, not knowing the social etiquette and what the weight of that was. But I did so anyway. And she came, so which was great. And then I walked her out afterwards, and in the lift of Anvil House. This was before Anvil House was Blueprint.
So years later, you'd catch that lift to church.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
The church came to you, bro.
Church came to me. That was wild. She asked me, she's like, what do you think about God? Yeah, so they took me by surprise, a bit blindsided by the question. So I couldn't answer in the moment. And in the moment, I was like, we're in an elevator, girl. Like, oh my gosh, this is not the time or place to have this conversation.
I give you an answer in the 10 seconds before we hit the ground floor.
Yeah.
I just love how every other story like that is like, we were in the lift and we hooked up for the first time.
That
you
was
know?
So where I
but
thought it was going.
Like the quality of Sharon's character that she's like, what do you think about God?
yeah, totally, for sure. And it's partly that bravery and that sort of honesty that I admire about her, is that, hey, I am who I am no matter where I am, what state I'm in. Mm. Following that, we had some really good chats, some more intense conversations and some more understanding conversations. And it was quite difficult, admittedly, navigating those waters of faith, asking myself in that moment, selfishly, like, what does God mean to me? Who is God to me? And am I ready to talk to God again? You know, am I ready to end that radio silence? But following that, I spent the next 6 months to a year going to both churches, because there was a lot I had to work out, there was a lot I had to decide, there was a lot I had to think about and process and pray about, because it is quite a big decision to say that I'm a Christian and to commit to that. So I wanted to make sure that whatever decision I made next was deliberate, was intentional. Throughout going to church and in my life, I saw people who just went to church on a Sunday and there was very little evidence of Christ in their lives throughout the rest of the week. And I was very decisive and chose very early on that I didn't want to be that.
But you mentioned that there was kind of this thing for you around needing to maybe prove yourself to God or earn God's favor.
Like, I want to just kind of caveat this with saying, like, I don't think it was evil or culty. I think people were just doing the best they could and sharing the best message they could in their own understanding. How they treated people, how they nurtured their children and taught their children, used just a sort of reward and consequence model that just bled out into their spiritual part of their lives. And so it kind of started in small actions, like you go to a church and you kind of help clean up, help vacuum, help do stuff. And it was kind of like doing chores racked up these sort of God points, which contributed to, I don't know, going to heaven. And also, if you did something wrong, you'd lose some points also. I'm hyper-generalizing here, but I'm just trying to draw a picture. And so what that meant in life was that, like, you would have a yearning to help people, a yearning to be good, but there was also that thing in the back of your mind that, like, hey, if I do this just for my own well-being, my own goodness, my own merits, it almost seemed forced or disingenuous. There was that part that was always asking, do I want to help this person because I want to help this person or because I'm called to help this person? Or is it that motivation to help that person has been driven by this need to satisfy this point system?
That's really interesting, some of what you say there and how you identify that exists in both experiences of religion, that exists in Taoism and also exists in Christianity. And I wonder if part of it is kind of linked to this desire in us. You keep on talking about our desire to be good. Almost it's like our desire for innocence, is quite big. Has that been a strong driving force, kind of part of the hunger that's led you forward? It sounds like you've always wanted to be good.
Yeah, I think so, for sure. And I didn't realize this till last night, and saying this out loud. Admittedly, my wife helped me realize this. This isn't my own revelation. Is that through the teachings of Confucius, of Buddha, of Jesus, learning to recognize Jesus and learning to recognize God in this world, learning to recognize that goodness, like, how do we identify that, you know? You say good, but what is good? And so attributing that back to that Jesus was the Son of God and came down to earth and in flesh and showed us how to live by example, you know? And so all those moments where I learned to open myself up to hearing from God in a number of different ways and to feel those pushes or those nudges, those little God moments, I'd call them, of when God has prompted you or encouraged you in a certain direction or to do something for someone. Learning to identify, learning to open myself to Jesus and, or firstly accepting, and then learning to be aware. I love a quote from Richard Rohr. Sorry, I think quotes are lame, but but to quote Richard Rohr, a line that stuck out to me from his Universal Christ podcast, or Another Name for Everything, sorry, was that Christ is everywhere. You can't avoid Christ. You can only choose to ignore him. And I think for a large part of my life, I was doing that, and just learning to open myself up to everything that Christ meant was a big decision. It's a decision I'm happy with, but also, like, yeah, has influenced me in many ways.
Something that comes to mind for me is imagining you as a wee fellow, you know, doing this vacuuming and, like, cleaning the toilet and, like, doing the mahi to kind of earn some brownie points with God. And it's almost like you're scoring up these tallies that you kind of, you go and do all this stuff and then you bring it before God and say, look, God, look what I've done for you. As opposed to this sense of which God meets you in an opportunity and the sense of God flowing through you and outworking love and service, and that God is really present in that moment, as opposed to God is completely not present and you bring what you've done before God and say, hey, God, look, here it is. Is that kind of true, the sort of God being not present versus God being everywhere?
That's a really good question, Rose. I guess thinking about this, the driving factor for actually coming to Jesus, not that you can think your way into it, but I am strange and I tried to think my way into Jesus, was the main difference was I was caught in this dichotomy with, you know, my experience of knowing God from a young age to having to earn his or her love, but up to your preference. Like, that just didn't compute for me, because if you have a loving parent, you don't need to convince them to be loved. That was a large question I had, and something I struggle with, to be honest. Like, you can try your hardest to think your way to Jesus. Some people might get there. I can say I definitely did not. what really was the turning point. You know, me personally being able to open myself to God and kind of welcome him in to my heart again. I don't know if there was an exact turning point, but once I learned that I was worthy of being loved by Jesus, and worthy of being loved by the community I was surrounded by, worthy of being loved for who I am, and that I can come as I am to God with, you know, all the good things. Like, thank God for all the good days, all the good moments, but also when things are hard, to be able to bring that to God as well. And not be ashamed, not be feeling like I had to always be earning love from our spiritual parent, I suppose.
Yeah, that it's incredibly, incredibly beautiful. Your story is such a perfect articulation of what the gospel is, a life wondering how to be good or how to be good enough, and arriving at God who said, I've already made you good. And I just can't stop thinking of the story of the prodigal son, you know, who comes home thinking that his father will be frustrated with him, but finds this father who says, didn't you know everything I had was already yours? Incredibly powerful story. Shang, if you were to, say, travel back 4 or 5 years in history, this is a question we've been asking people, and you were to meet Shang of 4 or 5 years ago and to give your little pitch for Jesus, what do you think you might say to yourself?
Oh, that's a hard question. To be honest, me 4 years ago, I was going through losing my dad. That was the only thing that was happening. And so, to be honest, knowing my stubborn self, no matter what words I could conjure up, nothing could convince me at that point of going to Jesus.
Shang, that's actually, though, that's a fine answer to this question. Is that actually, you know, there is actually something in that of like, actually, there's nothing I could have said to myself.
That road just had to be walked.
Yeah, that road just had to be walked, and God was doing something in the midst of the pain you were feeling with your dad and a whole bunch of your story, and weaving that together. And I think a lot of people would answer it the same way, that they couldn't have actually arrived at Jesus any earlier, that it was just a journey that they had to walk.
I also think it must have, and just this is just kudos to you generally, like that understanding of like a God who you like earn your way to and earn your favor for, like it must have been incredibly painful to see like your dad's such a faithful guy, and that he had worked so hard and lived so much for his faith,
so faithfully,
and then to be like, oh, how is it that you could die this way if you know you've done all this stuff, like that reckoning of those things together, that must have just made the stakes very high.
So what I'm really interested in is, what were some of the barriers that made it hard for you to come to Jesus?
One of the biggest barriers, I guess, was disappointing my family, because my family sacrificed a whole lot to move their whole lives to a different country where they didn't speak the language, which, yeah, now moving to Japan just a year ago, I can very much say that it is extremely difficult. And just post-dad passing away, having to tell my family that, yeah, I am going to Christian church, and even saying the words out loud that I am a Christian was really difficult because of all that meant and all that could possibly happen. Because on one hand, it's, if you want to just unpack it briefly, it's basically, in a way, slapping my parents in the face, saying all that they had done, all that they had sacrificed was just discarded and not really valued, which is not the case. And to come to tell your mother, who, you know, you have one parent left, and to tell her that the traditions she raised you in were insufficient and that found something better post her losing her husband was really difficult.
And yet, I guess, like, you did make that choice, hey? So there was, like, a lot of pain there. You know, why? Why did you choose that?
Yeah, I'm interested too. I'm interested that somehow Jesus was worth it.
I guess, like I said, like, no words could have convinced me of Jesus, to be honest. It was not until, actually, I could probably put my finger on a few moments that actually turned me. First was when I first met Sharon, in that first period of us dating, these questions were popping up, like, who is God? Who is God to me? And I was praying about it. It came to a decision point, and I was like, God, give me a sign. I don't know. I can't decide. Like, I knew in that moment I wanted God in my life. I knew there was God. I had faith, but I just didn't know how to be a part of a community, how to do the actions and all that. But in that, praying for a sign from God. God then moved Blueprint to my work building.
So the church moved in, what, four floors beneath you, eh?
Yeah. And so this was very immediate. This was like wildly quick. I was like, I prayed about it like start of the week, end of the week. Somehow, like, I can't remember who told me, but like Blueprint was moving in. And I was like, okay, well, I mean, okay, cool. Like, I get it. That's, you know what? And what other, yeah, it's just such a wild thing to have happened, to have God be like, I want you so much, I'm moving my house to your house. You know, at least that's how I felt. And following that and learning to open myself up some more to hearing from Jesus, just experiences like I was walking home from work one day down Courtney Place. I walked past this homeless guy like laying in the doorway of some shop. I looked at him and I felt sad. Kind of put a little prayer out to Jesus as I walked away. And even before I hit the corner, I was walking beside Tony Millions. And I could feel this like almost giant hand kind of like turn me around and push me towards Tommy Millions.
So Tommy Millions is a pizza place, right?
Yeah, Tommy Millions pizza place. And I was like, okay, God, I get it. All right, I get it. So I bought a couple slices of pizza, went and just sat and chatted with him. And then he brought up Jesus. He brought up church. He brought up Christianity. He's like, brother, do you know Jesus? I was like... And what was incredible was just that weekend he had been baptized at a church in Wellington. He was given a Bible and he pulled out this little pocket Bible out of his pocket. He's like, check it out. Like, I just got a Bible, just started reading. His eyes lit up. He was just so ecstatic to like share this new love, I guess. I don't know how else to describe it. Just, it felt like it was Jesus being a bit cheeky, I guess. Afterwards, he asked me to pray for him. And at that point, the whole praying out loud thing was pretty new to me. Didn't really know what to say or do, to be honest. Didn't really know this guy, but closed our eyes and put hands on each other's shoulders and words just came flowing out. It was like the Holy Spirit just kind of worked through me in that moment. Gave him a hug and walked past a few more times following that, but never saw him again, unfortunately. And it was just small moments like that where... I don't know, I'm a stubborn person, so I needed more tangible signs of Jesus. And Jesus knew that, fortunately, and met me where I was, which no words could have convinced me of that.
I love that story begins kind of almost cringy. The guy coming home from work decides to shout dinner to a homeless guy.
Yeah.
But then, like, the mutual liberation that happens in that, where actually, you know, you grab some food for the dude, actually, but he actually gives you a bigger gift.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, that's really beautiful.
Like this different hungers, like you come and like are able to meet the need of like his physical hunger and you had this like deep spiritual hunger. And I guess Christians being like one beggar tells another beggar like where they can find food. This kind of like food of life that this guy shares with you. And just that kind of feast that happens in the doorway on Courtney Place. Like I love that little moment of like, and then a giant hand directed me towards the pizza place. And I'm like, a little bit can relate to that, you know? Just real drawn into buying treats on the way home from work. But kind of that nudging from God that we do have those moments to choose. You kind of say there's that stubbornness in you, but then there's also this allure and this draw from God upon you.
Yeah, I think this has been an amazing conversation, and so I appreciate your story, Shang, and your willingness to share it with us.
Shang,
huh? Yeah, really interesting stuff from Shang, I thought.
I mean, there is so much. I took a bunch of notes. There's so much interesting stuff. One of the things you need to know about me, Scotty, is of issues that I struggled with when I was trying to solidify my faith, when I went through my big deconstruction, the number one on the top of the list was how do other faiths fit into this thing? That's been, that was, so I spent loads of time studying other faith and just how can Christianity be credible? I was saying to Scotty before, I didn't know that there was such a thing as Taoist missionaries. You know, I was really taken aback by that. And then I was drawn in. I was like, oh, yeah, I've always wanted to meet a Taoist. This is just like the dream. We know lots of, you know, mish kids, what we call mish kids, people who are like the kids of missionaries who go overseas. And so you sort of become familiar with a Christian mish kid story. Mm-hmm. You kind of understand how that's weird and whatnot. It's so strange being on the other side of it.
Like knowing that there are missionaries of other faiths coming to New Zealand.
Yeah, and how weird it must be coming to New Zealand, like culturally isolated, trying to learn different languages.
There are pamphlets, Spanky, with like you and your kids in like other countries. Like, look at these heathens.
Oh yeah, true.
You too could go and convert these heathens.
First thing I was struck by was how close his relationship with, call it the divine, as a kid. Remember, he's talking about that. He's walking down the road. There's a real sense of God being with him, God being close. There's actually this sense of a closeness. Here's the fascinating thing. He likes that God by the sounds. Like, he's actually, and you often see that with kids, like it was just the most natural thing in the world. Where it became strange is when he both encountered Taoist thought. He didn't ever seem to entirely gel with the merit system. He was really struggled with that. And with the Catholic education system. And neither of them seemed to gel for him. I thought that was fascinating that there was a connection he had as a kid, and yet he was groping around trying to work out how does this fit with these other places. I found that very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he talks about that idea of, and other people on the season have talked about it too, of returning to something that he had as a kid. Yeah, and even talks about, I think he said at one point that like churches kind of always felt like home to him, even when he was young, whether it was Taoist or whether it was Christian, it always felt like home to him. And he talks at one point about the idea of kind of these rules or these precepts being put on top of things that actually kind of were less helpful to his faith. It's really interesting. I've been reading this book recently by James Fowler about the stages of faith, and he starts off by talking about the difference between faith and belief. Belief is like our identification with a set of facts, you know, that we go, this is what I believe. It's sort of like your doctrine statement on your church website. But then he talks about faith, and he grounds that in like some of the original like French words around that, and says it means the thing that your heart leans upon. He likens it to courage, like cœur, you know, being heart. And so like the difference between this thing of like belief and faith, and it's almost what Shang talks about, is growing up as a kid with faith, that there was just a sense of safety and this leaning upon, and then came belief. And it's when the precepts and the rules come in that he starts to become less familiar with this God. I think there's like something also interesting in Shank's story around that sense of safety, and that sense of safety being in family and being in faith, and then sort of some of this unraveling also following alongside his father passing away too, and just the impact that had on his belief and his questions for God.
So that's one of the interesting things of his story, is the old bastard suffering brings its head up again. And what I was struck by is from Dow's point of view, which is much more framed around merit, and you know, you do this many good things and there'll be that much kind of reward. I'm not expert in this area, so if you are a Taoist listening or a Taoist scholar, forgive me if I have got my foot in a bit, but much more merit-orientated than grace-orientated. That's what I'm picking up. And it was interesting how he asked the question, how is my father deserving of this death?
Yes. Yeah.
Which is the same question that so many Christians ask when suffering comes. So it was like the same questions are getting asked. I thought it was fascinating how often that question leads someone away from a Christian or from Jesus, and how for him it pushed him out of the frameworks of Taoism and ultimately led him towards Jesus. But it made you realize how huge a deal it was for him. It was not easy to, in the end, come to Christian belief. Having to front up to tell your family and your mother who's grieving, to say, this thing that you have invested in me, this thing that you've passed on, is left wanting. It is not, has not proven adequate. And if you think into just somehow of those Asian cultures operate, the shame honour between parents and kids. I mean, it's very hard for Westerners to understand.
Yeah.
It's a big old deal of what he did. And then I think it took great courage to front up to that.
You have similar kind of things in having spent a bit of time in India and in Hindu faith, where the reincarnation of your parents is bound up with your faithful service of the gods. So for you to become a Christian, you're also throwing away the next life for your parents. So I think those kind of concepts are concepts we can't get our heads around quite the same way here.
Do you know what I loved about this story is one of my favourite evangelism tools finally comes into play, which is the flirt to convert. And
convert a hottie.
Yeah, and finally there's that elevator interaction. There's a love interest.
Yep, yep.
And you know, you can see he's going, oh, I'm going to have to walk away from a whole lot of things here, but she's amazing. Do you know what I mean? You can tell. And I'm glad that that's come up because I know so many, particularly young guys, whom that was really kind of how their faith locked in, is they sort of had a strong-minded woman that sort of insisted on them coming along to. I mean, they were idiots anyway, so I mean, it was fine for them. I thought it was interesting. What was the turning point was when this thing around Jesus, and I totally take this for granted, that one of his profound movements before he kind of had some signs was this profound thing where with all of his baggage, he's like, I'm worthy of being loved by this Jesus, and I'm worthy of being loved by this community.
Mm.
I'm loved for who I am, and I'm loved as I am.
Mm.
And it's not about earning stuff. This was a massive thing for him where I don't have to, you know, pull myself up by my own bootstraps, or it's not around merit. I'm entirely free of that. And I think I have grown too familiar with that in terms of that's what Jesus has to offer. And you could tell that this was just such a profound revelation.
Well, I mean, and that is such kind of a basic thing that maybe we don't talk about that much, but is religion as this means by which we are made clean. And the need for absolution, you know? And so much of what Shang talks about in this interview is wanting to be good and wanting to be right, you know? And just wanting to feel good. It's really interesting, you know, Sunday nights at Blueprint, which is far from an Orthodox congregation, but we do like a quick Eucharist. And when you get to that part of the liturgy that says, God forgives you, forgive others, forgive yourself, you can actually hear a pin drop in the room. Like with this crew of millennials and Gen Z, the desire, whether it's receive that forgiveness or to be reminded of that forgiveness and to know that I am good, to hear that once a week. Like, and I find personally, I await that, like after a couple of years ago, being in India for a while and then arriving at Westminster Abbey in the UK, and there was this Eucharist service there, and just to hear those words, know that you are forgiven, be at peace, incredibly powerful. So I think that driver to be good and to be made clean and to be made worthy is like really important to us.
I thought interesting him talking around the barriers, and of course that big barrier being disappointing your family and telling your family, and I would have just gone on secret. I would never have said anything. Amazing he turned up and did that. But what do you make, Scotty Reeve, of, in his story, is a story of someone who encounters the good news, but then says, but if this is really you, you're going to have to give me some signs. I need some signs and wonders. And then he has that encounter where he meets the homeless chap that basically evangelizes him. And he has that sense of, remember the hand actually steering him towards the pizza shop. And then this weird situation of Blueprint moving to his workplace. I love that little phrase, I'm going to move my house to your house. You know what I mean? Like, how do you feel around that? Because, you know, I get nervous about saying to people, well, you know, you should pray and God will show up and give you some signs. Because I sometimes experience people are just numb and they can't experience anything much. How do you feel around those signs and wonders?
Yeah, I guess it's like it's scary, particularly for us as leaders and for people who really care about another person, maybe who they're hoping will come to faith. It's scary to like surrender control, eh? You know, as a leader, sometimes the scariest thing you can do is go, let's have 5 minutes of silence and just wait for God to show up, because you can't control it. You can't do anything about it. You know, you have to entrust that God is doing a bigger thing than we are to facilitate the space.
You've made your point.
But, you know, like it reminds me like back to Charlotte's story where she's on the silent retreat, you know, and has this encounter with Jesus that is unmediated really by anyone else. And it is hard to trust, eh? Because sometimes we think we know, and I actually think this is some of our biggest problem. I think this is a big part of our reticence towards sharing any kind of faith, is that sometimes we have decided what people need And we look at our friend and we go, oh, because I can see this in them, therefore God will need to do this, or they wouldn't be into that. But it's been funny to observe some of the most unlikely people link in with a version of spirituality or a version of Christianity which looks totally different to the one you would have chosen for them, eh?
I remember there was a chap who worked in doing lots of weird expressions of church in the UK, and he said, the thing is, after you've done lots of weird expressions of church for long enough, he said, the thing you learn is that God confounds. And what he means is, someone comes into your really interesting, you know, like back then it was like, say, cafe church. He said, and lo and behold, a year later, they're worshipping at the Anglo-Catholic parish down the road. Gone to your stock standard charismatic service. You know, these people, he was saying, is just all over the show. Like, and I think one of the things around giving up control, and I think, and I struggle with this, but leaders are the worst for it, humans are profoundly mysterious beasts. We barely know what's going on within ourselves. I mean, that's one of the great things about coming to faith, is at least someone knows what's going on in here, because I don't know what's going on. And there's a sense that God fully knows me much better than I know myself. And that's part of the good news, is to somehow be known in that way. And all of our friends, whatever we think they need, they probably do need some of that. Like, you know, they probably do need some. But humans are profoundly mysterious, and you know, we're only at the tip of the iceberg of really understanding what's going on intellectually, spiritually, emotionally.
So I think sometimes, you know, when I look back on the early days of Blueprint about 15 years ago, we thought we were so cool and so edgy and so relevant in our presentation of the gospel. And now I look back on it and I go, we were not actually hitting our culture at all. You know, like our sense of how good we were presenting it to the world was so far off what the world needed. We still looked like total numpties, you know, but we thought we were really nailing it. You know, like having church in a brewery or having church in a cafe was actually just not hitting the mark for people. You know, actually our attempt to engage with the culture sometimes was way off. And that's kind of told me 15 years on that, that actually I'm just not sure sometimes we know what people need.
I think we have to have real humility to sometimes go, well, God's up to something in this person's life, and I've got some opinions on if I think that's okay. You know, like I've got some ways that I want to correct them or move them so that their experience aligns with something I'm more comfortable with. You know, all those things start to happen. But sometimes you just got to go, well, God's up to something. It's probably a really long journey. I'm probably a bit actor. And maybe a much larger
production.
And let's just do our best to play along with what God's up to. I don't always mean the path of least resistance. Sometimes that does mean difficult conversations. But let's sometimes just let God do what God's up to and try to tune into that, rather than I've spent a lot of my time trying to get people's odd shapes into my cookie molds. And it's just not healthy for them. And a lot of that came from my own insecurity. And
do we believe that actually when people are up for meeting Jesus, maybe they don't actually want just a re-representation of their life and culture that they know, but they actually want something different?
Maybe they've
actually come to a place where the longing within them is not for what they've already seen or tasted, but for something that is a bit weird and is a bit outside the norm. And
I have hung out once. I got a friend. We both got a friend called Cassie, and she came to faith at a community I was in. Not many did. She was perhaps the only one. And, and man, I love hanging out with people who have just come to faith, because they're into it. And there's an energy about it that almost makes you uncomfortable, because it makes you realize how they're asking all the questions you should be asking. And you know,
that's right.
There's a gift of encountering people who are freshly on fire in that way.
Well, I mean, that's what I've seen around some of our communities, is that the person coming to faith serves an essential part in the kind of ecosystem of the church.
Yeah.
Because they will believe with a naivety and with a gratitude. So they actually bring us all alive again by having folks around. And if a church doesn't have people coming to faith, it's normally a dying church on two fronts.
Which doesn't bode well for some of my activities, I'll give you that. So I don't agree with that too strongly, but I actually ultimately think you are right. Yeah, it's like the seasons of growth. Is it springtime that you need to be seeing that going on?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, the other thing I thought was interesting is how he prayed with that homeless chap, and how he's like, I don't even know how to pray.
let alone praying out loud. You know, it's everyone's worst nightmare, and that these words just started flowing out. I thought that was a really interesting. I think that might have been a very important moment for him in terms of a sense of God really being with him and empowering him in that. Hey, other thing, last thing I noticed about his story. I love when it's like, if you could go back, what would you say to yourself? And like everyone else, he said, nothing. I'd be too stubborn. And I think everyone's almost has basically said that. I think sometimes we've thought, if only God could show people the right piece of evidence at the right time. But actually, I realize that God's working with, again, deeply mysterious and complicated people whom are open when they're open, and he seems to go for the jugular then. What strikes you from all this? What's your big takeaway?
I think my big takeaway from that conversation with Shang was this particular line where he talks about kind of moving from knowing God as a kid to having kind of knowledge about God. That he kind of felt like he was onto something, that he intuitively connected with something of what God was like as a kid. But then kind of all these facts were added to it and all these things that bound it. And for a time, he loses it. And what he actually eventually has to return to is not a knowledge about God, but is a knowing God. And that's kind of the place that brings him real freedom. I think for me, that was kind of one of the most powerful thoughts.
You want to ask me what I think? Go on.
Spanky, what was your big takeaway?
Thanks for asking, actually. The thing that I am struck by is his childlike sense of a relationship with something that is with him and is near. And then his comments, and I thought this was really important for a Western Christian Pākehā to hear this. He made a little comment that will stay with me where he said, I think you can find a sense of the sacred in churches and in temples and in mosques, and that those are deeply spiritual sacred places. So often there's a bit of a rhetoric which is not sure what to do with those spaces of other faiths. And I think there's sometimes this idea that is there lurking evil there, and how does all that fit? And I think he raises a thing that we've got to understand, that God is often somehow at work in these other faiths. That often those other faiths are groups of people trying to make sense of what they're encountering with God. So I've often hung out with people whom are very negative around people of other faiths. And every now and then I've hung out with someone who's done real mission work who says, there are things going on here and you best be a little more humble, my friend. You know, and I think I'll take that away is I need to open my mind a lot more, particularly when I'm starting to encounter religious expression and cultures that I'm not familiar with. I need to stop boxing the thing in and I need to just listen and go, what's going on for this person? So, as well as flirt to convert. I mean, that's the big takeaway. That it's basically bulletproof. It always works.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan.
If you can successfully flirt.
Mm.
There's probably a lot of women out there, Spanky, you and I have put off the kingdom over the years.
Can't save them all.
Can't save them all. You know, I saw this great meme the other week, and it was a guy saying, he's like, I don't understand. I can't get a date. And the other guy says, are you flirting? He says, yeah, I bit my lip. And he says, maybe next time the bottom lip. To iTunes podcast or Spotify and give us a rating. That'd be nice, eh?
I forgot about that whole system. All right, Scotty Reeve.
All right, Spanky
Boy. Until next time.
Let's go to bed. Do you keep these filters or do you make them each time?
I had to make this one.
Whose pantyhose are they? Seriously.
I don't know if the red ones. This one was her maternity pantyhose. I don't know where the red ones came from. Maybe it was one that someone, like a second-hand one that someone gave.
Second-hand, I've probably got some crotch.
Yeah, I know.
by Bitter World. And a big thanks to Chris Wynn for all of the music. Check it out on Spotify. Bitter World.